Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of this conversation, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Mario T. Garcia, author of Father Luis Olivares, a biography, Faith, Politics, and the Origins of the Sanctuary Movement in Los Angeles, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2018. Dr. Garcia is professor of Chicano studies and history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where his research and teaching focuses on U.S.-Mexico migration, Chicano-Latino community formation, identity, and politics. Dr. Garcia is the author of several books, biographies, and testimonials featuring the life and work of activists like Bert Corona, Sal Castro, and many others engaged in the struggle for Chicano civil rights and social justice. I'll also just add really quickly that this is Dr. Garcia's second appearance on New Books in Latino Studies. Our previous conversation was over his 2015 book, The Chicano Generation, Testimonials of the Movement, which was published by UC Press. So hello, Mario, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you, David. Thank you for inviting me, and it's glad to be with you again.
Wonderful. Well, it's a pleasure, again, to have you and to discuss this particular book, this biography of Father Luis Olivares, as well as so much of this focuses on the Sanctuary Movement in Los Angeles. So can you begin by telling us a little bit about how this project developed? I mean, specifically, why did you, you know, decide to write a biography of Father Luis Olivares? And maybe some comments on why it's important to have this biography now, particularly.
Okay. Well, I had known about Father Olivares because, of course, he was in the press and the media throughout the 80s. And so even here in Santa Barbara, of course, we read about him in the LA Times, and he was on television a lot and so forth over the struggles of the Sanctuary Movement. So I was aware of him, and I was aware of the important work that he was doing, but I never met him. And then he died, of course, in 1993. So I never met him. Later in the 90s, I began to be involved a bit more in researching Chicano Catholic history. And as I was putting together this book on Chicano Catholic history, it dawned on me that maybe an important chapter would be on Father Olivares and the Sanctuary Movement in Los Angeles. So that's when I began to do this research, actually, like in the early 80s, and began to search out his story and with a focus on the Sanctuary Movement. Of course, I couldn't interview him because he already had passed, but I did interview members of his family, some of the people involved in the Sanctuary Movement, and so forth. So I was able to put together that chapter, that essay. And that book was published, I believe, in 1987 by University of Texas Press. It's called Católicos, Resistance and Affirmation in Chicano Catholic History. And it's a series of essays, researched essays on different aspects of Chicano Catholic history that includes Father Olivares. One other one, just to note, maybe for your listeners, is a chapter on Católicos por la Raza, which was a really interesting Chicano Catholic group linked to the Chicano movement in Los Angeles in the late 1960s, and no one had ever written about Catholicos, and so that was a very important chapter. Indeed, no one had written about Father Olivares either. So that chapter moved me in the direction of thinking about doing a full biography. And it didn't take me long because he has some very fascinating history. So I began in the 80s then in the 90s. The book was published in 1997. I began to begin to do more research and discover documents and so forth. And maybe later we can talk about the research I did, because there is no Father Luis Olivares archive anywhere in the world. I basically had to discover and make up my own archives. But very fundamental for the book, and I don't think I could have done it, I did 93 oral history interviews, again, with a whole range of people, starting with his family, his brother, who was also a Croatian priest, and interviewed some of his siblings in San Antonio, because Father Olivares was born in San Antonio, 1934. And then, you know, people who, because I wanted to do a full biography. Yes, he was quite well known, or better known, I should say, for his work with the Sanctuary Movement. And that would become key to the book. But I wanted to do the whole biography from beginning to end. And so I interviewed not only siblings, but people who he had been in the seminary with in Compton, here in the LA area. And through his becoming a priest, his early priesthood, and then becoming later involved politically, his activism and so forth. So it has a kind of a longer genealogy in terms of becoming interested in writing his biography, but that's kind of the genesis of it. And I had other projects that I was working on at the same time. That's part of the delay and why the book didn't come out until a couple of years ago. But once I had assembled all of the material, which was quite large, it took me 3 years to write the book. And it's the biggest book I've ever done. It's over 500 printed pages, and it could have been longer. I had cut out about 60,000 words, but I'm glad that it finally did come out.
Well, thank you for that. And it definitely is a substantial and very thorough biography, although it reads, you know, very, very well. And, you know, so it is quite large, even as you just mentioned, the pages, though. I didn't even realize it was that long. It didn't actually feel like I was reading, you know, 500 or 600 pages. So well, you did a phenomenal job, really.
That's a nice comment. And, but it could have been long. You know, biographies, by their very nature, tend to be very large. You know, we have biographies of various people, and they can range up to 1,000 pages. Mm-hmm. It's possible I could have put together 1,000 pages, printed pages, but again, I knew my editor at University of North Carolina Press was already beginning to be a bit concerned. And so they didn't have to tell me to cut. I knew that I had to cut, and that's why I did cut those 60,000 words. But it's a substantial, book and covers all his life.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you also mentioned early, actually in the introduction, that it's, you know, although it's, you know, it is a biography, I think like all, you know, really good and well-written biographies, it also says, you know, something, has something much larger to say, right? So you mentioned that this is, you know, not just a biography of Olivares, but, you know, also it's a collective biography, mm-hmm. in ways of, you know, not just the Sanctuary Movement in Los Angeles, but, you know, all the people that he was involved and surrounded with. So it doesn't surprise me when you just said here that you said, how many oral histories? 93 oral histories. Wow. That really, I mean, that makes a lot of sense now when all the quotes and the depth at which you get here. So, but you definitely do get a much fuller sense and picture of, again, how the Sanctuary Movement develops in Los Angeles, of particularly all these different influences on Olivares' life and that get him to that point. So I want to get there in a moment, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to comment quickly on this concept that you discuss in the introduction, that is the concept of faith politics, you know, mm-hmm. And so why is that important? You spend I mean, you know, I don't know, probably about a page or two or so of explaining that concept. It's used not only in this project itself, but also why is it important larger, you know, in Chicano history?
Yeah. Yes. What I wanted to emphasize was that in the area of Chicano history, we've neglected the role that what I call faith politics involves. That is to say, a lot of people of faith, clergy, and but secular as well, have been influenced by their faith to become engaged socially, politically, in community movements. I can't say that I can say, okay, all of these people have been, but I just have no sense that if historians begin to look community by community, they will find other clergy and other people of faith like Father Olivares who have been involved in community struggles, including civil rights struggles or immigrant rights struggles. But we have developed, although it is changing, a kind of curtain that has divided the history of Chicanos and faith politics with Chicanos who we see as more driven by secular influences. And I think it's a false curtain or divide, and we need to correct that. The role of religion has been significantly marginalized in Chicano studies and in Chicano history. And that needs to change because I think that we're eliminating very important aspects of that history. And by faith politics, I mean people, again, who are moved by their faith to become involved. In the case of Father Olivares, up to when he becomes involved with the sanctuary movement, it's his faith that is telling him that he had to help the refugees and the undocumented Mexican immigrants. These were people of God, as he often said. They're the children of God. And I have to be with them. I have to embrace them. So his politics and his faith were intertwined. They were two sides of the same coin. And so so I think that's important for us to begin to understand how some people become engaged politically from their faith. Cesar Chavez was similar. Dolores Huerta was similar. But take the example of Cesar Chavez. I mean, there's no question that his deep devotion to his Catholic faith was central to his activism, to his leadership in the farm worker struggle. There's a telling comment that Cesar made after many years of struggle. Someone asked him, what has kept you going? What has kept you involved in the farm worker struggle with all the ups and downs? And he said, well, it wasn't a political doctrine. It wasn't an economic doctrine. It was my faith. That said it all. It was his faith. And so Cesar is another example of faith politics, of someone who is practicing faith politics. I mean, Cesar was not cognizant of, for example, liberation theology, as Father Olivares was. But Cesar practiced liberation theology. And the core of liberation theology is to have a preferential option for the poor and for the oppressed. Well, that was Cesar's mission. That was he was engaged in with the farm workers. And so too Father Olivares, that who was much more attuned to liberation politics out of Latin America, out of the late 1960s, which again basically said that the main role of the church, the Catholic Church, was to be with the poor and the oppressed and to assist them and help them and be part of their struggle and so forth. Well, Father Olivares became a liberationist, And you see it very clearly in his struggles, and even predating the sanctuary movement, because in the late 1970s, where his activism really begins to manifest itself, he becomes a key leader of an organization in East LA called UNO by its acronym, which stood for the United Neighborhoods Organization. That was an Industrial Areas Foundation, Saul Alinsky-influenced organization. But Olivares comes to it already influenced by liberation theology. And so here he's working with, again, poor people or Chicanos in East LA who still face many, many daunting conditions and lack of opportunities. And he begins to apply his leadership with UNO, and he led their signature campaign that put him on the political map, which was to challenge the big car insurance, automobile insurance corporations who were charging exorbitant and discriminatory auto rates in East LA.
Right.
UNO took that on as his first major challenge, and it was Father Olivares who became the head of that challenge. And after a 2-year struggle or so, they were able to defeat these corporations and get the insurance rates rescinded. Then when he goes to La Placita in 1981, he goes there at the very moment when the Central American refugees are entering. And as I said earlier, he immediately embraced them, and that laid the foundation with the decoration of La Placita Church, Our Lady Queen of Angels Church there in downtown LA, as a sanctuary in 1985. And then he expands that 2 years later to include undocumented Mexican immigrant workers. No other sanctuary movement throughout the United States ever did that, to expand it to include the undocumented Mexican immigrant workers. So faith politics, again, is a way of trying to suggest that we need, as historians, to see about the role of faith in Chicano history. That doesn't mean, you know, that we're going to be looking at, you know, people praying and people.
Yeah, right.
It means how do they use their faith to become politically involved in a progressive fashion?
Right. You know, and so much of that rings true to me. I was just telling you before we came on and started recording, I recently took a group of students with some colleagues down to South Texas in relation to a Latino civil rights class that we're teaching here at Brigham Young University. And we met with several former activists, particularly involved in La Raza Unida. And what comes to mind as you were mentioning that is, you know, our last day of this trip, we're meeting with Rosie Castro and Mario Compeán and others. And Rosie specifically said that being raised in, you know, a household where they you know, read, you know, the New Testament a lot and read about, you know, Jesus Christ's work among the poor and all of that, that, you know, is really what influenced, you know, her at a young age, you know, to develop these notions of social justice, right, mm-hmm. what's right and wrong. And that mm-hmm. really planted the seed, right, to become involved, right? And so as you're discussing that, right, that I think perhaps when we, or, you know, maybe that the partial hesitancy of historians or scholars to address religion, particularly within, you know, those activists that, mm-hmm. you know, that have been very much prescient in the movement, but it is because there's a whole spectrum, right, of how people express their faith or may or may not, you know, refer to it as one of the primary impetus, mm-hmm. right, for what they do, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, but anyways, it, like I said, it definitely rings true. It's several, I can think of several other people that we met with, you know, they talked about their households when they were young, you know, Martha Cotera and others that we met with, you know, and so they just talked about that influence of where this sense of ethics, of morals, of rights and wrong came from. And mm-hmm. several of them reference, you know, not only their families, their home, but also particularly the religious traditions they were raised in.
Yes. So I don't think that's very true. And, you know, it would be interesting when we do a survey over the years of Chicanos Latinos who emerge as key leaders and so forth, how many of them would say the same thing, and how many of them had maybe went to parochial schools. And that's where at least some germ of social justice was placed in them, if you will. And I suspect a good number would be of that kind of background. What I think, going back to why there's been this gap in terms of not only religion but faith politics, really, in my opinion, goes back to the Chicano movement, because the movement saw itself as a very much a secular movement and had a mistrust of religion. But what they meant was that was the establishment church, and with good reason, because in many ways the establishment church had not done as much for its Chicano, Latino parishioners. That was the whole motive for Católicos por la Raza in L.A. But religion isn't just the established church. Religion is how people in their own way practice it at home. This is popular religiosity.
Right.
And for some of them, you know, that also probably, you know, it's been part of the backdrop to why they become involved politically. But again, even having said that, my sense that you could find many other clergy, priests, somewhat similar to Father Olivares by various community studies that can be done in terms of priests who were involved in parishes in Navarios and how they were involved politically. For example, I mean, I mentioned UNO in L.A. Well, UNO was organized around the Catholic parishes. COPS in Los San Antonio, which was organized a little bit earlier, was also organized around the Catholic parishes, because the idea behind both organizations was to get the clergy involved. And by getting them involved, that would help impress upon their parishioners the importance of they themselves getting involved and in movements that would help to improve conditions in the barrios. And so, you know, I expect there's a lot of Father Olivares types over historical periods that we could examine as well.
Right. Well, you mentioned a few of these key you know, relationships and organizations that Olivares had that, as you put it, promote this conversion that Olivares has, right? And this conversion from a Gucci priest, right, to a social justice activist, right? So you already mentioned that he had contact with Cesar Chavez. He worked with UNO, the United Neighborhoods Organization. He also, right, had contact and worked with those that were associated with COPS in San Antonio and whatnot. So you want to piece that together a bit more for us and describe, you know, the basis for this conversion, because that seems to be in somewhat a kind of transitional moment, at least in the biography as you write about it.
Well, yes, because Father Olivares began his priesthood not as an activist. This is, we're talking here into the 60s. And he was ordained in 61. But he became very much enmeshed in the bureaucracy of the Claretian Order, which was his order. And he rose very quickly up the ranks. I mean, he had already displayed this in his seminary years. Keep in mind that when he went to the seminary, he was only 14 years old. This is what in his period of time, this is how young boys were recruited as potential priests. Their teachers, predominantly nuns, would look for the best and the brightest and help encourage them to believe that they had a sense of becoming priest. This is what happened to Father Olivares, and also a year earlier for his older brother, Henry. So, but in his seminary years, that covered basically his high school and his college and post-college, postgraduate work in theology, he displayed already tendencies of leadership. He was smart. He was articulate. He was engaging. He had a great sense of humor. But he had leadership qualities. And that's why after he's ordained, he quickly moves up the ranks of the Croatian order. And in the mid-1960s, he is named treasurer of the order, which was second in command to the provincial. And as treasurer, his duty was to raise funds for the order and to invest the monies that the order had through their properties and through donations and through other ways that they were that they had funds. And indeed, Olivares was handling a multi-million dollar portfolio. And his task was to invest it in Wall Street in order to increase that portfolio. So he would be wined and dined by Wall Street bankers and financiers. They would pay for him to go fly first class to New York. They would put him up in first-class hotels, take him out to first-class restaurants, get him tickets for Broadway shows. And Father Olivares loved that. He loved that lifestyle and embraced it. And he dressed the part. And people say to me, he looked very elegantly and very well-dressed. And people ask me, well, how can a priest be well-dressed and look elegantly? Well, aren't they all dressed in this drab black? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, yes, he dressed in black. That's true. But how about a silk black suit? Not an ordinary suit, but a silk black suit with French cuffs, a silk white shirt. And then, as you noted earlier, his famous Gucci shoes. Mm-hmm. And that's why some seminarians began to refer to him as the Gucci priest. And some later referred to him as Father GQ. And but that was who Father Olivares was at that time, except by his own admission. In 1975, like St. Paul, he was converted. He underwent a conversion, not a lightning bolt like St. Paul, but in his case, he said, my conversion was in meeting Cesar Chavez for the very first time. And they met in 1975. Cesar went to see Father Olivares to see if the Claretian Order could help fund some of the strike activities and boycott activities of the UFW. And he was just totally impressed with Cesar. And from there, he began to work with the UFW. He and Cesar became very, very close. And indeed, Father Olivares, in many ways, was Cesar's confessor. He would often go up to Delano or to La Paz to be with him. He married a couple of the children, including Paul Chavez, and would speak at the conventions of the UFW, usually in Fresno. And so that was how he started becoming politically engaged. And while he remained treasurer, he requested that he now be based out of an East LA church, a parish. And so he was assigned to Soledad Parish. And there where his work with the UFW even increases, you know, he allows the UFW to begin to help organize the boycott activities in East LA out of his church. And it's from there that he encounters UNO. And the UNO organizers who come to East LA very quickly realize the leadership qualities of Father Olivares and bring him into the folds of UNO, and he embraces UNO, and as I said earlier, becomes one of the key leaders. Certainly, he was clearly the key clergy leader, he not only did he work with on the insurance, but on some of the other activities of UNO, and also he became in many ways a key spokesperson for UNO. That's why he became kind of already a kind of a media star in the late 70s. He was on television, English language, Spanish language, in the press and so forth, as a spokesperson for UNO, and especially during the period of the struggle on the auto insurance rates. So that was his conversion. It becomes an activist priest. And it's during this period of time, as I suggested earlier, that he also encounters the concept of liberation theology. Mm-hmm. He begins to read into liberation theology and to learn from it and to see how it applied or could apply to him. And of course, he did then begin to move to have that preferential option for the poor and the oppressed that he, you know, manifested in UNO and then later with the refugees and the undocumented. But he didn't begin as an activist. He became an activist. And he wasn't born as a liberationist. He became a liberationist and continued to evolve and to apply, you know, his commitment to working with the poor and the oppressed into the next decade of the 1980s.
Yes, you know, it seems that a key part of this transformation for Olivares also, in some ways, kind of liberated him to really embrace his Mexican-American identity. You know, he's. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that? I mean, it seems that
that's a good point. I'm glad you raised that, David. Yes, because I mean, of course, he knew he was of Mexican background. He grew up in the barrios in San Antonio, in West San Antonio, and. Grew up speaking Spanish, you know, his father spoke predominantly Spanish, his grandmother and his aunt, who really became kind of his mother after his own mother died at a very, she was young and Father Olivares was only about 4 years of age. But he grew up in a Spanish-speaking household and a Spanish-speaking world there in West San Antonio. Of course, he learned English by going to the Catholic schools there in that community. And but he, when he went to the seminary, I mean, in the seminary years, I mean, there wasn't much emphasis on issues of ethnicity. But at the same time, I mean, he tended to kind of bond together with the other Mexican-American kids at the seminary, including his brother Henry, and they would. On their own, they would speak Spanish, and even occasionally the term Chicano was used amongst them. And so, no, he knew of his ethnic background, but it wasn't something that was central to him. But later, as I described, when he undergoes the conversion and begins to work with the UFW, with many of the Mexican Americans who were part of the UFW, and certainly with UNO in East LA, which was predominantly with other Mexican Americans, his sense of ethnicity comes to the fore, and he begins to embrace that and to, understands how important that identifying with his ethnic background is, because he's working with other people of that same ethnic background, and how that sense of ethnicity helps to, in a way of bringing them together, helping to organize them and so forth. But his sense of ethnicity identity, I think it becomes sharpened when he begins to become politically engaged. I don't know that he ever used the term Chicano as he applied it to himself. I don't think he had any problem with, but he didn't use the term himself, at least as far as I could tell. But he had no problem with people who called themselves Chicano, and he had no problem. I mean, in the height of the Chicano movement, as I say in the book, this is when it's his non-conversion years. He must have been obviously in LA aware of the Chicano movement, you know, the walkouts and all of the other manifestations, including the strong Chicano anti-war moratorium movement. But he was not political, at least, I mean, he was, if he was political, it was political in terms of his order, of supporting his order in the way that he did as a treasurer. And but it's not until after his conversion. So he didn't have an identity with the Chicano movement, was not engaged with it. But his political activism comes later. And but his sense of ethnic identity is there. It's sharpened as part of his ability to reach out to the Central American refugees and the undocumented Mexican workers and so forth. And he's able to do that in part because of his ability to speak Spanish. Although, you know, he was bilingual, but in those seminary years, English became his dominant language. When he becomes converted to faith politics, he in a way has to kind of reacquaint himself with Spanish and to be able to speak more in Spanish and very significantly to be able to give his homilies, his sermons in Spanish, which he had to do, like at Soledad Parish and then later La Placita. And he became a very capable speaker in Spanish, and that added to the power of his homilies. Beginning with Soledad, but moving into La Placita, his Sunday sermons, his homilies, were political sermons, to the extent that he always connected the gospel reading to politics of the day, much of it in terms of the sanctuary movement, but in terms of immigration and other issues as well. And by all indicators, and based on my interviews, he was a powerful, powerful speaker. And of course, he was, during the period of the sanctuary movement, of course, he was also engaged with groups that were protesting against the U.S. involvement in Central America, in supporting the right-wing governments and military and death squads in El Salvador, and then also attempting to overthrow the Sandinista Revolution in the 1980s. And Father Olivares, part of his faith politics was to be engaged with those groups as well. And he became kind of titular leader of some of these organizations and was often asked to speak at rallies and at conferences or conventions. And so his sense of his ethnic self becomes part of his faith politics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Well, it seems that his next, then, you know, transformation after, you know, his kind of political and identity kind of transformation occurs is, you know, his public, right, embracing of the sanctuary movement, right? So in, you alluded to this before, early, you know, in 1981, he's, as soon as he moves to La Placita, he starts to embrace and provide, you know, use the church as a place of refuge for these refugees. But he doesn't make a public announcement, doesn't publicly declare sanctuary until essentially 3 years into the larger sanctuary movement. And you write that once he does that, this is like the pinnacle, right, of Olivares in his career, like kind of like everything has been leading up to that moment. Can you explain more? You know, you put so much emphasis on that, why that is, what is it about how he expands, how he both initiates sanctuary and then expands it in LA that really is this culminating moment for him?
Yes, very much so. Well, when he goes to La Placita in 81, as I mentioned, this is the same time that the refugees are coming in. into the United States. And that will lead to, I mean, the origins of sanctuary movement around that time, around 81, 82, out of Tucson and Arizona. And then in time, the sanctuary movement will spread throughout the country so that various churches, Catholic, actually not that many Catholic churches, but certainly a lot of progressive Protestant churches and in some cases Jewish communities declared themselves as sanctuaries to try to help in any way that they could the refugees who were being persecuted by the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration, like the Trump administration today, was basically saying, no, these are not legitimate political refugees. They are illegal aliens coming to take jobs from Americans. So the policy of the Reagan administration was to apprehend them and to deport them. Well, a lot of good Americans stood up and said, no, that's not who we are, just as it's happening today. And they often pointed out, as Olivares did, it was the Reagan administration was breaking the law, because in 1980, under President Carter, legislation was passed on political refugees, and defining a political refugee, meaning basically someone who, if they were sent back to their home country, they would be either tortured, killed, or both. And so the sanctuary movement was basically telling Reagan, well, you're the ones breaking the law. We're not breaking the law. You're breaking the law. Sounds familiar. And so Father Olivares was embraced the refugees early on and began to systematically put together a range of programs to assist them, including allowing some of the male refugees to sleep in the church itself or in the basement of the church. That became quite controversial, not so much among his parishioners, who were very accepting of it, but in other Catholic groups, even in respect to the Archdiocese office, and even in the public, you know. So, but he housed them, and in the Wednesday, I mean, he was housing about 600 a night, but of course there were many others. It's estimated that in 1980s, about 1 million Salvadorians, for example, come to the United States. Half of them will come to Los Angeles. There's no way Father Olivares could house them or help them completely, because there were just too many. He did what he could. And of course, he believed in symbols, and he believed that at least it would be symbolic that at least one Catholic church, since most of the Salvadorians were Catholic, that at least one Catholic church was seen as a church that was there to help the Salvadorians and other Central Americans. And that included when he declared sanctuary in 85. But these programs that he established, and they became institutionalized there at La Placita, included feeding them, of course, providing health support. Some of them had themselves been tortured and so forth, providing psychological help, especially including people who had undergone torture or their family members had been tortured or killed, trying to find jobs for them, teaching them English to help them find jobs and to help them just kind of adjust to life in the United States, getting their kids into schools and so forth. And that all this became institutionalized in what was referred to as El Centro, Centro Pastoral. Mm-hmm. And so all this is already, he is practicing sanctuary even before he declares sanctuary. Now, why does he choose to declare sanctuary, you know, 3-4 years later in 1985? I think, as I mentioned in the book, it's at that time that some of the sanctuary people out of Tucson, the origins of the sanctuary movement in the country, they began to be persecuted by the Reagan administration. They will be indicted for various felonies of aiding and abetting quote-unquote illegal aliens, and they will have to go to trial and so forth. And I think that Father Olivares, along with his main lieutenant, if you will, at there at La Placita, Father Mike Kennedy, a Jesuit, felt that this was the time for them to also go public. It was important for them now to go public and declare sanctuary, in part in support of what was happening to some of the people who had earlier publicly declared sanctuary and now were being persecuted, prosecuted. So that laid the, you know, that kind of moved them in the direction. And so on December 12th, the Feast Day of Our Lady Guadalupe, and he deliberately chose the Feast Day of Our Lady Guadalupe, especially to bring in his own parishioners and other, especially Mexican-American Catholics, into supporting what he was going to declare. So on that date, December 12, 1985, he publicly declared La Placita Church as a sanctuary, haven, and church for the refugees. And that was a big step for him. It was, as you mentioned, in his way, I mean, it was almost the climax part of what he had been moving towards,
right,
in terms of becoming a activist priest, a liberationist priest. And but it didn't stop there, because 2 years later, as I had mentioned, he expanded sanctuary to include undocumented Mexican immigrants. And the impetus for that was the 1986 Immigration and Naturalization Control Act, IRCA, which did provide for amnesty for some undocumented if they could prove residence for a period of years up to 1982. But Father Olivares quickly saw the problem with this. Number one, most of the refugees who were perceived by the Reagan administration as undocumented themselves had come after 1982. What was going to happen to them? Well, they would be subject to deportation. In addition, thousands of undocumented Mexican immigrants were entering into the 1980s beyond 1982. What was going to happen to them? Well, the same thing. So he protested those provisions of the IRCA law. He had no problem with amnesty, but it just to be expanded to include the people that are still coming.
Right.
So he wanted to bring attention to that, and one way that he did it, and by the way, when he's doing all of these provisions, these programs for the Central American refugees, housing, all that, he's already doing it to undocumented Mexican immigrants. He doesn't differentiate. In fact, even homeless people are supported by these programs. He throws out a wide umbrella. And so it's no leap of faith, in a way, 2 years later, 1985, that he expands sanctuary to say now La Platita is going to be a safe haven, a sanctuary for Mexican undocumented workers. And as I said earlier, no other sanctuary movement did that. In fact, some in the sanctuary movement in LA, who in some of the groups that were against, for example, what the Reagan administration was doing in Central America, but some of them had problems with the expansion of sanctuary because they said this is going to kind of cloud the issues. I mean, we should continue to focus just on the refugees and not the Mexican undocumented. But, you know, that wasn't going to, affect Father Olivares. He said they're also children of God. They're in great need. The church is here for them as well. And I'm going to expand sanctuary to bring attention to the plight of the Mexican undocumented also. So, again, that was an expansion of that kind of, you know, ascension and climax of his career. And so, these were heady years and dangerous years. And as I write in the book, he got many death threats and he had to deal with that, but he kept up in his work, and it wasn't going to deter him in any way. And he was courageous. He was brave. He made several trips to El Salvador. He made one trip to Nicaragua, and he went there to meet with other clergy, to go to meet with the peasants out in the countryside in El Salvador, refugee camps in Honduras. And I found out, and I write in the book, it's really quite astounding, that on some of these trips, he would actually take large amounts of cash. Within the distributed groups that we're working with, people who were being displaced from the countryside in El Salvador, for example, and were flocking into the capital, San Salvador, and he would take literally cash in a suitcase. And it boggles the mind how was able to, you know, get through customs or whatever, but apparently he was able to do that and take that money to where it was needed. Mm-hmm. So just an incredible person. Because, and then again, he became a huge media star. I mean, he was always on TV, English, Spanish, all over the LA Times, all over La Opinion, other publications, radio as well. I mean, he was a spokesperson, not only for the sanctuary movement in L.A., but for the groups that were, again, opposing U.S. policies in Central America.
Gotcha. Right.
And just one further thought, Dave, to kind of really focus on the fact how important it was that he declared Sanctuary La Pasita. No other Catholic church in the huge L.A. Archdiocese had the courage to declare sanctuary.
Right. And no other church declared or, you know, expanded sanctuary for undocumented Mexican immigrants.
No.
Right.
No.
I think this goes to a point that you make early in the introduction in regards to sort of explaining why write a biography of someone that, you know, many Americans have never heard of. I mean, this goes into your discussion of, you know, the inclusion, the importance to include this history into broader, you know, American history and whatnot, and how this is both a, you know, an individual biography, but a collective biography. If you could speak to briefly, because I know we're running short on time, you know, how Olivares really, you know, in regards to like more local history, like LA and California, how, you know, being at La Placita and, you know, working with these refugees, I mean, he saw, right, and in many ways was already, you know, serving and developing programming to, you know, address the changing demographics of LA, right? Particularly mm-hmm. the shift from, you know, a very Mexican-American centered, you know, Hispanic LA, Latino LA, to a pan-Latino, right, Los mm-hmm. Angeles. Right. I mean, that's part of this, you know, he is the first in a number of things, right, to do certain things in the, whether it's in sanctuary or within the, you know, the Catholic Archdiocese in Los Angeles and type of figure he was, but even to, you know, broader regional history, I mean, on the ground, he was seeing and right, really ushering in this demographic transformation, you know, in ways that wouldn't be recognized till later. Right.
Yes. I mean, again, he brought together Mexican-American Catholics with the Central American Catholics. They didn't have to be Catholics, but he brought them all together. And that's what he did in La Placita. La Placita, prior to 1981, was primarily a Mexican-American parish. He reconverted that to a pan-Latino parish by bringing in the refugees into the services, into the masses. And he had a picture of the martyred Father Monsignor Romero in the church itself. And he brought his parishioners in together with the Salvadorans, for example, and people from Guatemala as well. So it really became a pan-Latino church. Like when he's choosing December 12th, Feast of Our Lady Guadalupe, was important in that kind of pan-Latinoism as well, because on that day, Virgen Guadalupe also became pan-Latino. She became also a Salvadorian saint. And so he understood the changing demographics, especially with the refugees coming in and so forth. And that was part of his, you know, attempt to bring to people's attention the changing demographics of Los Angeles. You know, what I try to suggest, and you mentioned it during, I mean, why study Olivares, the importance of how he is to, say, to American history and so forth. I mean, like, for example, when I approached my editor at North Carolina Press about my biography of Olivares, his first response was, who is Father Olivares? And I said, that's exactly why you need to publish this book. People need to know who Father Olivares. I got the same response, by the way, on my book that North Carolina did as well on Sal Castro. Who is Sal Castro? Why you need, that's why you need to publish it. you know, we've reached a point, especially demographically, but also culturally, ethnically, and so forth, where our understanding of American history has to significantly change and be revised and so forth. We need to bring in the Father Olivares, the Sal Castros, and so forth and so on. People I've written about in activists, Rosalía Muñoz, Raúl Ruiz, Gloria Arellanes. These people need to be now integrated, understanding about civil rights history and so forth and so on. I'm basically throwing out that challenge. I mean, this is American history. It needs to be integrated. But I also throw out the challenge in terms of California history. This is a California story as well. It's an LA story, but it's also a Catholic story. So I'm throwing out that challenge to Catholic studies historians. You guys need to know this as well. You need to integrate it as well and so forth. So the sanctuary movement in LA, you know, just to focus on that again, was the most important sanctuary movement anywhere in the country. No one else throughout the United States was doing what Father Olivares was doing in LA in terms of the services and the protection and the speaking out that he did on the Central American refugees. Mm-hmm. Most of the other sanctuary movements were limited. Maybe they might help a couple of families and so forth. So a lot of the other sanctuary movements were in many ways symbolic. At La Placita, not only was it symbolic, it was real. It was happening. And so if one's going to write about or speak about the sanctuary movement in the 1980s, which was so important, you've got to begin and end with what Olivares was doing in La Placita. I mean, there's just no ifs and buts about it. And yet that hasn't been done. Uh-huh. So maybe this book will help to revive that history of the sanctuary movement as well. So in many ways, I'm throwing out in that intro a lot of challenges. As I mentioned earlier, a challenge to our own fellow Chicano and Chicana historians. I mean, let's expand our interests and so forth, and let's look at the role of faith politics in various communities and so forth, or how that's part of the kind of issues that we're studying and so forth. But in a way, I'm also throwing out the challenge that we, of course, as you know, I mean, I've done biographical work, life stories, testimonials. So, and there's a heavy focus, obviously, on the role of leadership, but we need more biographies. I mean, there's so many biographical studies that, as you know, that can be done. Where's that biography of Mario Compián, who you mentioned?
Right.
Or Rosie Castro? Who's going to do that fabulous story of her and how she spawns up the two sons and so forth? I think that we need to especially emphasize to our graduate students, I mean, this is a fertile ground, biography. Yeah. But it's not that we're studying the great man approach to history. As you mentioned several times already, Olivares' story is not just a story of an individual. It's a story of a community. It's a story of a collective movement and struggles and so forth. Yes, of course, he's very important to that, and the role of the individual is part of leadership. But no leader can do what Olivares did by himself. It was a collective out of his parish and other people outside the parish who were in support of the refugees and the undocumented as well. So I keep always thinking, who's going to do that big biography of Dolores Huerta? Who's going to step up to the plate and finally say, you know, besides always saying, you know, we need to integrate Dolores, we need to, you know, everyone always talking about Caesar, who's going to step up? Who's going to step up and do that big, big biography? Whoever does that big biography of Dolores Huerta, I tell my graduate students, is going to literally leap in the historical field. Your career will be set for life. But no one's taken it on. I did an edited volume, as you know, on Dolores Huerta that's useful for college use. It's a big project, and I had too many other big projects, including the Father Olivares one.
Right. Well, I know that there are, and I think that's one of the things I appreciate about the introduction. I think it's both a challenge to, I think it's a challenge to the broader public, you know, as well. Number one, that there are all these figures that are there, that there are books on, you know, there are works on. I mean, I'm thinking of Lorena Oropesa's, you know, recent, biography of Reyes López Tijerina. So even Chicano scholars are responding. There's some young scholars, you know, doing wonderful work on Alicia Escalante, you know, and some others. And so, like, the stuff is coming. I think Gabriel Gonzalez, her work on Emma Tanyuka, at least her chapter, you know, in Redeeming La Raza. So it's trickling, but I think there's several things, and I'm agreeing with you that we need more biography. But I think to scholars, you know, there's several institutional constraints, right, for both those on a tenure track. Biography is usually not going to be the book that's going to get you tenure, right? If you have a tenure track job at a place that's going to, right, facilitate that. You also have, as you've experienced it and expressed, there's, you know, that type of barrier to get over with publishers, right? Particularly to help them see the value and say, you know, yes, these, you know, Latinos and Chicanos that you know nothing about deserve, right, significant treatment. But I think we're confident. I think as we look at to, you know, scholars that are coming up, I think we're going to see that more and more. We are starting to see it, and you're right. It's a trickle right now. We'd rather see the flood of it. I think it is going to happen. It's kind of one of those things that yes, as we read these and we know about these people, even my students, as they took this trip to South Texas, all of them were asking these questions. Where is the book on Marta Cotera? Where is the book, you know, on Rosy Castro, et cetera, right? So I think through some leadership, you know, not leadership, but, you know, guidance as well as encouragement, you know, a lot of our students need encouragement to pursue these type of projects.
Absolutely. I agree with everything you just said, David. And I think also one can say, I mean, there is now a concerted movement of scholars, young scholars and others, who are moving in the direction of religious history, Chicano, Latino, Catholic history.
Yeah.
And literature
is
beginning to really develop.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with that. Well, I know I've held you a little over time. I want to give you one moment. I know you have a very exciting conference coming up, the biennial Sal Castro Memorial Conference. Did you want to make a plug for that on our podcast for our listeners to be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I was going to throw that in anyway, David, but thank you for prompting me on that. Yes.
Because a lot of what we're saying, right, a lot of what we're calling for, right, is a bunch of it is presented in early form,
yes,
right, at conferences.
Because, I mean, as you know, I mean, there has been a renewed interest in the history of the Chicano movement over the last 10, 15 years. And as I began to realize that, I began to organize these conferences every other year on those people who are working on different aspects of the Chicano movement. There's almost a kind of a renaissance in Chicano movement historiography. And so the fifth biennial, and now the conference is called after the death of Sal Castro a few years ago, it's now called the Sal Castro Memorial Conference on the Emerging Historiography of the Chicano Movement. And it will be held February 28th and 29th. Here at University of California, Santa Barbara. And if people in other parts of the country, the state, and so forth, California, want to find out more, they can contact me directly. My email is garcia@history.ucsb.edu, UCSB meaning University of California, Santa Barbara. They can contact me for more information. It's free. It's open to the public. It'll be 2 days. We'll have approximately some 26 historians, but also some in the social sciences, some in literature, who will be presenting their research and their papers on different aspects of the Chicano movement. It looks very exciting, and if people, you know, want the program, I can send it to them via email attachment. So we're very excited about that, and this is done in part also to, well, not only to showcase the importance of these new works coming out on the Chicano movement, which is so central, of course. So much of what has become as Latino political power, Chicano political power, is so much of it comes out of the Chicano movement. Certainly tremendous gains we've made in terms of educational attainment, especially in the colleges and universities. We have so many more Chicano Latino students And a lot of that is a result of the struggles of the movement,
right.
Pressure on universities and so forth to open up to admit minorities such as Chicanos and Latinos. And of course, it's also, you know, to pay homage to a great American figure, Sal Castro, and his many, many years of being a committed teacher, of course, best known as an inspiration for his for the students who walked out in the historic blowouts or walkouts in March of 1968 that really called attention to the movement beginning to develop in the urban areas, and that the schools would become an important battleground for the Chicano movement to challenge a long, long history of segregation and inferior education that affected Mexican-American students over the course of the 20th century. David, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you again. And I hope that we'll get a chance to get together. I invite you to come to the conference if you can. That would be great.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I'll be there. I was just glancing over my bookshelf. The last time I was there, which I think was not the previous conference, but the one before that, Lori Flores was, you know, presented on her book that had just come out, Grounds for Dreaming. And Max Krockmal was there, and he presented a chapter from Blue Texas, which had not been released, but I think came out about a year after that. So definitely it's a
yes, and there'll be people, as you know, we have a special panel on recently published books on the Chicano movement, so we'll have, I think, about six presentations, so those are people that, obviously you might be quite interested in interviewing.
Well, phenomenal. I look forward to being there and seeing you there and hearing of all the great, wonderful scholarship that's coming forward. Mario, thank you again for coming on to New Books in Latino Studies. Best of luck in your future work and for a wonderful conference.
Thank you, David, and good luck. Keep up the good work. Thank you so much.